720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit of a shorter show today. We're going to get you to that Northwestern at DePaul game coverage for sure. A little bit early, but still lots to do here on the program. We are going to be talking a little bit later about net neutrality and how that affects businesses right here in Chicago as that net neutrality repeal has rolled through. And we're going to be talking about the Disney-Fox merger and how that's going to play in the entertainment and media world. But before we do all that, we are joined now by James Tarmey, who is a writer at Bloomberg. And Bloomberg has been taking a look at the art world as an ongoing series. And to me, what is very interesting about this piece in particular is just as disruption has hit so many industries that we've talked about here on the program, art is no exception and the art world is no exception. And it is very interesting as that disruption hits, often we see a lot of power shifting and control over work going to the creators and the artists. And it seems like the art world perhaps is no exception there either. James Tarmey, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So talk to us about this ongoing series and this piece in particular about an artist who is really going not the traditional gallery route and a bit more DIY in terms of career control.
Sure. So just in kind of broad strokes, the way that artists usually become very successful is through a combination of gallery support and then institutional support, be it from a foundation or curators or biennials and so forth. And so the kind of conventional wisdom, which is in fact still borne out in the majority of cases, is that an artist's values and kind of collector base really doesn't go anywhere without museum shows, basically, and museums acquiring these artists in kind of for their permanent collections. And I took a look at an artist named John McAllister, who is sort of flying in the face of that conventional wisdom. John McAllister paints paintings, so in that respect, he's a very traditional artist. And then he also makes paintings that are quite pretty, which is pretty unusual. Sorry about the terrible pun, but
puns are welcome. It's all good.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, art that is considered serious at this point, I mean, can be aesthetically pleasing, but a lot of the time it's not. A lot of the time it has theoretical justifications behind it. It has a lot of what I call international art English, which is generally unreadable. Kind of combinations of theory and kind of art speak around it. And McAllister's work doesn't really have any of that. And yet, he's become extraordinarily successful, even with people who normally collect the kind of art that I was talking about that's much more difficult.
What I'm hearing you say, perhaps, is maybe there's a little bit, it's more accessible. Maybe there's it's kind of changing or defying the traditional convention of maybe a bit of pretension around art and the art world.
Completely. And, you know, sometimes that pretension is justified, right? A lot of the time, contemporary art has a lot of kind of political messages behind it, social messages behind it, and those require some level of explanation. And sometimes that's kind of more difficult to explain than other times. And it's not to say that all of that art should be dismissed just because it requires a little bit more focus. But what's interesting about McAllister is that, yes, people seem to be buying the art simply because they like it, as opposed to a lot of the other artworks that people in the so-called kind of art world ecosystem tend to gravitate towards.
Right. I think a lot of times we hear things like so-and-so is an important artist, or they're, you know, this work in particular is so important. We hear kind of a perhaps a community consensus around a work to make it important rather than, I think, as you point out, secondary is often the conversation of whether or not it's beautiful, if it's something we like to look at.
Completely. And there's the imprimatur that comes from being in a museum that confers this level of legitimacy, right? And, you know, I mean, what we really need to go back to, because this is art which is for sale, is what it means to say that something is important. And when you're talking about an artwork that's important, really what you're saying is this is an artwork that has meaning in the kind of art historical canon to the extent that people will continue to find it as valuable, if not more valuable, than what you spent on it.
Indeed.
That's generally speaking the case. And so a lot of the time when people are selling artworks, they talk about how meaningful or consequential the artist is in relation to all the artists that have come before.
Right. And as you point out in this piece at Bloomberg, which I will tweet out after the program so everybody can, if you follow me on Twitter, you can read this for yourself. It is really, really interesting. He is really, the artist that you profile, John McAllister, he's really doing this kind of without some of those traditional avenues. And it seems to be that he's, as a result, able to put a little more self-determination, you know, have a little more control of his destiny as an artist, perhaps.
Well, I'm not sure how much he would agree with that insofar as, you know, I mean, yes and no, right? In a certain respect, what makes him so completely unusual is that he has the pedigree of an artist who is actually coming from, who's actually benefiting from all of these various, what I said before, these kind of various designations of prestige, right? He went to a very good school, he studied with an artist named Mike Kelly, studied underneath an artist named Mike Kelly, who's a very kind of superstar contemporary artist who's no longer alive. And he has a lot of peers who've since become kind of major art market darlings, including the artist Sterling Ruby and the artist Aaron Curry, who are all making kind of pretty conceptual art at the time. So he has this kind of reassuring background that says, okay, this is a person who knows what the vocabulary of contemporary art should be. And also, right, it's not like someone discovered him in a flea market, right? But simultaneously, he is making art that doesn't look like those artists' art. And the kind of really prestigious contemporary art dealers around the globe are still responding to it, right? So that is what makes it pretty anomalous. I would say that he's still kind of relying on dealers. What he's not doing is he's not relying on museums. Particularly interesting about McAllister is that his collectors aren't relying on museums to justify their purchases, right? They're not saying, oh, well, this is in the Museum of Modern Art's collection, so I can feel okay about spending $80,000 on it, right? They're just spending $80,000 because they enjoy it, which is pretty unusual.
Right, indeed. And so do you feel that as you were working on this story and as you've been working on the series about the art world, do you feel that what McAllister is doing, is he a one-off special case? Or do you think there is a shift in the art world, the way it is run, the way art's purchased, and the way art is collected?
That's a great question. And I have to say that I think that he's more anomalous than the norm. You know, I think that there is a group of you can cherry pick and find some people who don't necessarily have curatorial support, but who are doing quite well. But I still think that what people really have to remember when they're going to a museum and when they're going to a gallery show is that the mechanisms through which artists and art have become kind of designated as serious or investment worthy or critically important are really have pretty much been static for the last 100 years or so, and I don't see it changing very much because art is fundamentally consensus based, right? The way that, I mean, there's obviously an art historical canon, but that canon changes on a yearly basis. So the way that people kind of decide that something is exciting and the way that people decide that something is important is through kind of a series of different organs that are the product of the market, right? There's the art critical press, like magazines like Art Forum and Frieze. There are curators who are both independent and work for museums who put together shows that sort of anoint various artists or reinforce those artists' reputations. And then there are dealers and gallery owners who put on these shows and really kind of push these markets, these artists' markets. And then there are the collectors who basically are funding all of this. And there have been many attempts, I would say most prominently through kind of internet platforms, to try to quote-unquote democratize art. But fundamentally, when you are using something like the internet, you are able to appeal to a much broader audience, but a broader audience, A, isn't particularly influential in that regard, and B, doesn't have the money to spend on these artworks, right? John McAllister, for instance, is quite cheap, quote-unquote, and he still costs $30,000, right? $30,000 for a lot of people is a lot of money no matter what you're spending it on, and particularly a lot of money when you're spending it on something that's going to hang on your wall. And so, really, you're looking at a very, very, very small group of people who are, in effect, deciding what's important because they're the people who can afford to pay for it. So do I see that changing anytime soon? Honestly, no, because it still costs a lot to make art, and it still costs a lot to sell art, and it still costs a lot to show it. And until that changes, I don't see too many disruptions happening.
Right. Well, very, very interesting to take a look inside the art world. And again, I'm going to tweet this piece out a little bit later this afternoon after the program, and be sure and link to it on the podcast page. So James Tarmey, writer at Bloomberg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break and be back in just a bit. And we're going to be talking about net neutrality here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be talking a bit about the Disney-Fox merger and what that looks like in the entertainment world. But right now we are joined by phone by Ali Marotti, business reporter at Chicago Tribune and regular contributor to this program. Hi, Ali. Thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, Ali, you wrote this really interesting roundup of sorts about Chicago companies that may be impacted by net neutrality and kind of talked to them a little bit about what they think of it. And I think a lot of people are trying to make sense of what the net neutrality repeal is going to look like in very practical terms. So what did you hear from Chicago business owners?
Yeah, so I think the important thing to remember is that people don't really know yet. You know, we don't know what the internet service providers are going to do and how they're going to respond to this. But a lot of people are worried that basically what they'll do is sort of set up toll lanes on the internet. So what that would look like, they're concerned about is them charging more for people or businesses that use the internet more or do certain things with it, right? So right now, or under net neutrality, the internet was sort of regulated like a utility is. So small companies, small businesses like startups, the ones that we talk to, they're really worried that that will put them at kind of a competitive disadvantage. So if they're having to pay more to get their products to their clients or to their customers, they're saying that that would affect their bottom line and would basically inhibit growth and innovation.
I've kind of anecdotally been hearing that a bit on social media from smaller startups about, you know, just finding the customer or more importantly, the customer finding them. And I think that seems like one of the big spots is, will I have to pay to find my customer and can I still reach them organically just by, you know, optimizing my content and regular social media interaction? I think that seems like the kind of the first mountain to climb with all of this.
Yeah, one of the founders that I spoke with, he runs a small company called TreeTail. It's an online buying platform, and they just launched, like, I forget the exact time, but 5 weeks ago or something. It's very recent. They're very small. They only have a few employees, and he's worried about, you know, if they are charged more for their internet usage. He said that they'll basically have to make a choice between where they put their resources. And it's basically either going to be, you know, making the product better so that the consumer is having a better experience, or focusing on the back end of sort of reducing bandwidth and trying to find ways to reduce the cost that they might have to pay. So that's definitely, he's worried about their consumers suffering from that.
Did you talk to any business owners that were perhaps taking a different view, perhaps either kind of neutral about it or quite in favor of it?
I did, actually. One person I talked to that I didn't make it into the story, he was a little bit like, you know, we don't really know what this is going to look like yet. And when these things happen, people tend to panic and think that the sky is falling. But that's not always the case. We also talked to a professor that pointed out, you know, that this has happened before. There have actually been 6 policy reversals related to net neutrality in the last decade. And he argued that this is going to have very little impact on daily life. And So, yeah, I think it kind of remains to be seen a little bit. But you do hear, from the consumer standpoint, a lot of people are pro-net neutrality. But those that supported the repeal sort of said, this is just going to take us back to where we were in 2015, before this was in place in the most recent time. You know, these are Obama-era rules. So, yeah, you are hearing something from the other side of the aisle as well.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how it continues to unfold and really see how it plays out in our practical lives. And there are a lot of states that are immediately filed appeals and tried to push back against that, Illinois being one of them. So that, of course, changes timelines. And I think that's a very important point that you make, that a lot of times we tend to panic when we hear about a big sweeping mm-hmm. change, especially when it's a bit unclear. Did you get the sense as you were talking to small businesses and mid-sized businesses here in Chicago that was there any confusion about the terms of what it'll be, or did you get the sense that most businesses pretty much did their due diligence and kind of know at least what the rules are?
Yeah, I think they're familiar with the rules, but the question is, how will internet service providers respond to those rules? You know, and that's something that there have been promises made and assurances and things like that, but it's you know, you can't really predict. It remains to be seen. So I think some of these businesses that we're talking to are sort of bracing for the worst, but again, it'll just depend on what route these internet service providers decide to go.
Right. Remains to be seen. Well, we will keep turning to you as the story continues to unfold at Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much, Ali Marani, for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to wrap things up a little bit early today because we're going to get you to that pregame at 12:45 for a 1 o'clock tip-off with Dave Innett and Joey Meyer. So stay tuned for that, but we got a little time to talk about some things. And here is one thing we could not get through a business lunch without talking about, and that is the Disney-Fox merger. It is really, really big news because we're talking about just two titans in the entertainment industry, just big, big companies, and really what that means. Griffin, I assume you've been following this story very closely too, because it's just such a big one.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And the Washington Post has a really great piece on it that really details it, you know, kind of play by play, and really, really speaks to the nuances of it. But I think we cannot even begin this conversation without saying it is yet another thing the Simpsons predicted long ago.
Did they?
Yeah, like a screen grab of a Simpsons in the maybe late 90s that was floating around the interwebs yesterday of a marquee, of a picture of a marquee of like of a Fox some movie produced by Fox, but you know, underneath it said a Walt Disney production.
Wow, and that's really funny.
Another thing the Simpsons called it.
Such sages over there, because I feel like every time something new happens in the news, you see someone take a screenshot of some Simpsons episode that's like mirrors it perfectly.
Right. Certainly, well, politically, you know, they've drawn Trump in several times.
Well, Bob was just telling me his prediction for the future of entertainment, and it worked perfectly with this story too.
Bob, what is your future?
This is my prediction. What? So I saw the Star Wars movie last night, and it's fine. You know, I don't want to get too far into whether the movie was good or not. I mean, it's worth seeing.
Uh-huh.
It's the strangest thing. Tell me if I'm wrong, Bob, but it seems like fans don't like it.
Don't like it.
Non-fans, yeah, I didn't dislike it.
Like it.
My take on it is a lot happened, but we're kind of back where we started.
Okay, I've heard a couple of people say that.
Because a lot does happen, and you're like, but really kind of we're back to where we begun.
Yeah,
that's my tweet length.
And you're a Star Wars fan.
It's the first movie I ever saw, so it made an impression.
Okay.
And just grow. I really grew up in the Star Wars era.
Sure.
They're my generation's Beatles. That's basically it. We didn't have a Beatles.
Okay.
I mean, I love the Beatles, but...
Right, yes. Well...
So here's my prediction, right? The Star Wars movie is essentially a reboot of the earlier Star Wars, right? It has a lot of the same kind of structure and stuff and certain cues that are there. So they're going to run out of things to keep rebooting. So here's my prediction. Within our lifetime, they will do a Star Wars, Star Trek movie and other kind of universe blending things. I'm not saying it's a good idea. I'm saying they're running out of gimmicks.
Well, so. And there's already a version of that happening at Marvel. You know, they make these standalone superhero movies and then they bring them all together.
Right, but they're in the same universe. So this would be the equivalent of like Superman, Spider-Man, but even more.
This would even be weirder.
This would even be weirder. And I think within our lifetime, this will happen.
Interesting. Well, okay, so
it's funny, like the things your brain does when
the connections we make.
It would be insane to have Superman and Spider-Man. Now, Superman and Batman, sure, yeah, absolutely. Which I know that's like.
I was just about to say
but
that.
Even weirder is Star Trek and Star Wars because they're Star Trek is 23rd century, then, Star Wars is a long time ago,
and then like Superman in Star Wars. Like, why?
I think that could happen. Archie Bunker in Star Wars. Why not? Let's just completely.
Now that we got to see. Well, you know, Will Wheaton, who played Wesley Crusher in Star Trek: The Next Generation, of course, he
told to shut up many times. His character,
right, told to shut up by Captain Picard many times. He wore. He tweeted a picture of himself going to see Star Wars, but he was wearing his Starfleet outfit to the event.
See? So we're already bending towards
I think he's on board with the Kessler plan here. Okay. So there's that.
Well, and that's kind of, I think it's a, I don't know if I'm worried about that, but you do get like this monolithic media entertainment culture that is sort of, not frightening, but it's something to wonder about when Fox and Disney merge like this. There's a $52 billion sale, and Disney bought Fox.
It's an unbelievable amount of money, and it's just such two giants in that space. And I think, I mean, to your point, Griffin, I think any monolith, generally, there are issues, right?
Yeah,
with something with just that kind of just massive footprint of power there.
I mean, on their own, they were already, not to overuse the term, but like monoliths on their, like Disney owning Star Wars is already like a sign that, wow, they have arguably too much clout. They have Star Wars and Marvel.
Right.
I mean, they're running American movies right now.
Indeed. And I think
worldwide,
a footnote to this is that with this, this all stock deal, Disney's also going to acquire Fox's 30% stake in Hulu, which is very interesting because I think, you know, these, OTT sort of networks like Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, everything in that category, those online platforms, they've been morphing in recent years. Like we talked about this on the show in the last year, earlier this year in Sundance, they were there with acquisition money in a new way and major players. And so I think it's really interesting to watch the things, what Hulu does, what Netflix does, what Amazon does, and especially how they're giving a lot of power to their creators and partnering with relatively unknown people that just have a great idea. So I think that part is really interesting when you have a monolith owning, you know, a pretty big chunk of something like Hulu. I don't know what that will be. Well, any predictions there, Sage Bob?
I don't have any predictions, but I see your point. I watched the Netflix movie Mudbound last weekend. Yeah. The only actor I recognized was the guy who plays Mike from Breaking Bad. I forget his name. He's a great actor.
Right.
I had no idea who anybody else was. And that was kind of an independent movie. It was a good movie. I don't think that movie would have been made for theatrical release. And it was better than like a made-for-TV level movie.
Right.
You know, it was worthwhile
watching.
Well, that's
an interesting one. I mean, that was produced before Netflix bought it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mudbound was. And a lot of Netflix releases, especially like bigger scale movies like that one or the Meyerowitz stories, the one with Adam Sandler and Ben Stiller, it came out earlier this year. They're produced, and then Netflix sweeps in and makes the purchase. So, but it is true that they are just changing what can be made, and I don't know. They've got so much money to throw around, but this one still has to go through the Justice Department, which did sue to block AT&T's purchase of Time Warner. So, but that seems confusing. It seems like antithetical to their aims in this administration generally. So I imagine this one goes through. I don't see anyone saying that it won't, but who knows?
I don't see a lot of it either. And to me, it's very interesting because we came from, the entertainment world came from this place of these just a tiny few number of studios, and it took some smaller studios doing something really remarkable to pull some of that power away. And it seems like we're kind of backtracking backing into exactly what we've innovated for so long to get away from.
It's true. Yeah. And the studio system back in the day, I mean, produced many classics, but this is a different thing, and it feels weird, and I'm afraid.
I kind of am, too. Yeah, I mean, I think generally you and I are both a little distrustful of any kind of monolith. I think that's a theme that comes up a lot on the show.
That's a fine way to be.
It is a fine way to be, so Yeah, so there's that. Anyway, that does it for us. We're cutting the Wintrust Business Lunch a little bit short today because we want to make sure to get you to that pregame. Pregame is here seconds away at 12:45. Tip off at 1 o'clock. This is Northwestern at DePaul today with Dave Innitt and Joey Meyer.